This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org.
I was going to kind of deal with just one of the questions, how do we actualize ideas presented in the exhibition beyond the space and time of the exhibition? But so what I'll do, though, the way that I'm going to try to do this is to kind of try to get at the notion of what it is in an exhibition like this that you might want to take beyond what the exhibition is. Because I think that's the biggest challenge is, when you're working within the social environment, it's about trying to figure out how you can look at all these moving pieces, moving parts, and can distill something that that you can identify what it is that you can actually kind of move it beyond. And so I'll start, though, by just looking at this image here. This is a painting of an artist named John Biggers. And like an exhibition, a work of art, is symbolic of something. And so the question is, how do you absorb and take what's in the exhibition or the work of art or whatever it is that you're experiencing and figure out how you can take that experience beyond where it is. And so that was my reality with kind of looking at this John Biggers painting, seeing it as a thing in itself, right? But also seeing some parallels between, what this John Biggers painting is all about and, these little shotgun houses that are in the Third Ward area. And so that's kind of the beginning of my exploration. But what I'm also going to do here is I'm going to talk basically about things that I've been engaged with Project Row Houses over the last, 15 years or so. But I'll also kind of intersperse a few other little explorations that I've been engaged in along the way. So this is kind of a little 15-year view of my approach of trying to take things from a given expression into a different realm. So okay, so once again, after seeing these little shotgun houses, and then looking at these John Biggers paintings and trying to figure out, is there some relationship there and how can you take what's in this work and take it outside of it in a different form? And so the first step, for me, was really to kind of resolve within myself, what's meaningful about, these paintings and what's the relevance to this possibility of these little shotgun houses in the Third Ward neighborhood of Houston. And so there was this kind of a framework that I set up for myself in terms of looking at these paintings and trying to figure out, what are the values in it. And I was able basically to extract about five components from this from these paintings. And this guy did a lot of paintings about shotgun houses. And and I look at them as kind of being expressions of ideal communities. And so how do you construct an ideal community as this guy constructed within his paintings? Well, first of all, I mean, obviously he gives a lot of attention to architecture. That's a big issue for the communities that he designed within his work. Secondly, there's art and creativity that's engaged throughout these works. And a lot of my distilling this comes from having conversations with him about, what's within these communities that have value. The third thing was that education is always important. Fourth, that there's a social safety net, how we take care of those that are less off, how does the community do that? And then fifth, the economic sustainability of a place. And so as an artist and not an architect, not a trained designer, my approach is to, put forth some kind of strategies that can actually look at how you could bring this environment that has some relationship to what was expressed in these paintings, but in a different form, in a different realm. And so constantly my my challenge was to explore and interact with the physical site, but also, you know, the populations around it, and figure out how to engage people in a way that could be transformative of this project. So, you know, first of all, we tried to honor the architecture, and doing that in a number of different ways by not only it wasn't an effort of fundraising to rehab a project. It was a way of engaging people in a very grassroots way in terms of kind of moving this from the dilapidated housing state to a more finished physical environment that then we could start looking at how the layering this community that this guy, John Biggers, talked about, you know, with arts, education, social services, and so on and so forth. And so part of that, making sure that there's an arts component, you know, we set up an arts program. But this actually goes back to the architecture of just kind of was one of the things that we had to really teach ourselves or learn about, you know, the relevance of this architecture and seeing how the front areas were much more kind of public areas, and these back courtyard areas becomes kind of little private spaces. And as we were able to reclaim the site, we began to see how it actually functioned. The front, very kind of public. The back area, much more intimate with, you know, possibilities of groups coming together because they're protected both on the front and on the back by the houses, the way that they're organized there. And so for us, though, education, well, having an arts component was really to be able to have a site that we could bring artists in on an ongoing basis. I'm very glad that one of the artists who just left Houston, Stephanie Diamond, who actually teaches here at Parsons, was a part of our arts program just recently. But bringing in artists in an ongoing way to kind of make sure there's a creative energy there, but also education with young people was a big part of it. I'll just show you a few images of artists that have, you know, worked in the in these houses. This is Whitfield Lavelle, fairly traditional approach. This is another Jan Mabry, who is worked with our Young Mothers program, which is a part of the social service program. This is a project that an artist, you know, the spaces are used in a lot of different ways, and this particular one was using it in a way of, after Hurricane Katrina, making a connect for the evacuees from New Orleans that were living in Houston. And but as a part of kind of regenerating this site and trying to look at, you know, how to reclaim this as a community the way that John Biggers talked about it, there's the notion of sustainability. And we realized we couldn't sustain ourselves in a vacuum, so we have to expand out, and we involved ourselves in acquiring a lot of property that we could actually do kind of sculptural interventions as kind of placeholders until we figured out other things we were going to do in terms of development. So these are just some open areas where, you know, either used as kind of gathering spaces or sculptural opportunities. Also really trying to make sure that the project responded to the indigenous language of the community, and making sure that, you know, that we weren't kind of taking it in this direction, which was very easy to do, you know, in Houston, where developers don't really deal with history very much. We could have turned our backs on that, but we wanted to reinforce that by looking at some of the local things that people were doing, which is, this is a yard artist, the Flower Man, and we got a house that we allowed him to kind of do his work there, but also acknowledging how that kind of work impacts other things that are going on. So, you know, once the Flower Man set up, then all of a sudden we start seeing other people taking little bits and pieces of that, not going as far as the Flower Man, but, you know, kind of these using these little fake flowers as they go along. And but the thing about this project was that our success also began to be a part of our added new challenges, because once we were able to make the site kind of a destination within this neighborhood, then all of a sudden it was a destination for other people that had other ideas of development. And you can kind of see these are just traditional where these larger townhomes are. There were probably a year or so before this was little shotgun houses like the ones in the front. Now, I'm actually, since I want to kind of stick within the 20-minute time frame. I'm going to scoot through these. But like I said, I was working on Project Roadhouses, but I've also tried to engage in different projects to kind of learn something about this idea of how do you take something that is symbolic in a way and then translate it into a different form and different environment. So this was at a show at the Museum of Contemporary Art in L.A., in which I found it what was called the Watts House Project. And it was in response to this actual piece here, which is actually a bound book of the five master plans for the Watts neighborhood that had happened in a 20-year time period. It was just, I mean, every 3 or 4 years, the town, the neighborhood of Watts would somehow manage to commission a master plan, and nothing ever happened to it. It just continued to, you know, amass as this, you know, document of plans. And so in response to that, the approach that I was kind of introducing was one of much more action-oriented than planning-oriented. And fortunately, I had a group of young artists that worked with me on that. And now I'm very glad that there's a young artist, Edgar Arsenault, who has moved forward with the Watts House Project. And this is an image of what's going on now with the Watts House Project. I'm going to skip through this one, which is Philadelphia. Okay, so once with Project Row Houses, after about 5 years of doing basically a historic preservation project, it was an opportunity to start looking at, you know, how do we integrate or introduce, you know, a different kind of design element that dealt with life issues that were related to contemporary life that's outside of the historic preservation rim. And so we formed a partnership with Rice University School of Architecture and started they started the design build program, and we were their partner within the community. So this is the first house that was designed as a single family house, but learning about what the issues were in the community, we took that same box and turned it into a duplex, in which we've been able to kind of take that and filter it into the community as a different type of development, a little bit higher density than was before. But at the same time, you know, trying to look at the scale of these little small boxes that the Shotgun House represent, and this is an artist studio space. Oops. But also, you know, looking at preservation in relation to that. So this is a new house that's here, but these are some of the older houses from the 1800s that we actually moved to the site because they were being demolished at another area. And then also doing, you know, some commercial projects as well. The one of the things that we've always tried to do, though, was to try to figure out how we connect with the memory and the history of a place as we move forward. So you'll find things like this. We've formed a new use for this place, but it still has the name of Delius, who was a very significant person that owned this lounge. And so they're still acknowledged there. This is an old ballroom space, the El Dorado Ballroom, which we've been working on for the last several years. And this is just a map that just kind of shows some of the different projects. This is the original 22 houses of Project Row Houses here. And these are new duplexes. This is an office space, smaller houses here. This is actually, this map is a little bit old and doesn't have all the updated information, but just kind of shows the broad area in which we're working in. But at the same time, realizing that we were kind of, in a sense, pushing out against developers that were kind of pushing in on us, we had to figure out a different strategy that was a little bit broader than what we could do, since Houston is a town without zoning. So we had to figure out, you know, how do we control land use without, you know, owning all the property? And this is a long discussion here, though, but I'll just tell you briefly, the thing that we tried to do was we formulated partners with other institutions and property owners within the area to form kind of a block of people that understood the direction that we were trying to move in. And this just kind of shows you the where we are and the forces that we're dealing with. Like, this is the Central Business District here. University of Houston, Texas Southern University, which is a historically black college. The medical center is down here. The museum district is here. And Project Roadhouse is right in this little area here. So there's kind of pressures coming from all these larger, you know, institutions that are kind of pushing their way in because it's closer. The ones on the outside are pushing their way closer into the city, and then the city's pushing its way outward. I'm going to kind of roll through this quickly. This is another little smaller project that I did with a group of students, which challenged these students to look at kind of reclaiming a space and building a little park as it relates to a community that they were interested in. This is another, that was in Houston as well. This is another project with that I worked on with Suzanne Lacey and Mary Jane Jacobs in Spoleto, in Charleston for the Spoleto Festival, which was all about creating an opportunity to have for the Charleston community to have a conversation about some of the issues that were going on with that that vast vacant area that was that we worked on that site. This is a view from the top. So this is the site where it was formerly a housing project, but I'm not going to get into those issues now. And around that same time, I had the opportunity, and that's great. You know how you work on a project sometimes, and you work on it for a very long time, and everybody's kind of exhausted about it, and then you kind of move apart away, and you're not quite certain what happened and how things went. Well, I'm very glad today that Glenn Weiss, who I worked on the Delray Beach Cultural Loop with, is here today. I mean, we had a long time of working together on this project, and we never really got together to unpack it, you know, what had happened on this this project. But it was really an interesting project that was trying to create a kind of a cultural exchange among the people of Delray Beach, centered around a cultural loop in which people could travel this 1.3-mile loop to kind of get to know the culture of the city and to generate a different kind of respect that people had for both the kind of the upscale part as well as the indigenous parts of the neighborhood. And let's see, I'm running out of time here, so I'm going to get quickly here. This is another little project that sometimes the idea of a project for me is that, you know, you're taking a particular image and you're kind of exploring that image, but it's really not about the thing that you're looking at. The thing that you're looking at is about is just a representation of what you're trying to do down the line. And I would also say that, you know, in terms of this exhibition, you know, I mean, the exhibition is one thing, but the exhibition is only there to kind of be representative of these ideals and ideas that we want to see kind of move out into the world. And so this is actually a little project that I've been working on for the past year. I started working on it this past year in Eatonville, Florida, which is the oldest African-American incorporated city in the U.S., the home of Zora Neale Hurston, where she was born and raised. And they invited me to come down because they wanted to preserve this little... This is the oldest building in the town. In fact, it's kind of the only old building in the town. It was the church that the town was founded in 1885. But since then, it's been a number of different things. It's been a house in its last incarnation, but it's vacant. And so, you know, what I've been doing with this is really, and I was, since I'm not a designer and architect, I have to take advantage of the resources that are available and build partnerships and collaborations. This is one with the University of South Florida School of Architecture. And what, you know, and what's interesting about this, and I'll just be brief on this, is the idea is not, it appears for the community that we're talking about preserving this particular house. And that's what they think they're, that's what they can immediately see is the issue. It's symbolic of something else, though. What is symbolic of is the dilemma that this town has in terms of how it's going to grow itself into the future, because it basically has, you know, demolished all of its historical context. And they have a bunch of developers that are kind of feeding them notions that's going to take them into the future, that's going to completely lose their, you know, the rest of their historic context. So this little project here only becomes symbolic of, you know, how do you shift the thinking about the significance and the meaning of history within this little town. The house church represents that in its own self, in its own way, but it's really not about this. It's about this broader community. And we're hoping that this particular project, though, as a symbol, will get us to a point that we can actually look at some of the broader planning issues that this little town is facing. Now, I'm going to finish on a couple of I can take like 2 or 3 more minutes. I want to finish on a couple little things that I've been working on that I'm trying to do for myself, is trying to clarify some things. I wanted to work on some small little pieces that are still social in context, but ways that I can kind of see it and define it in different ways. But back in Houston, you know, what I've done is, you know, you look at the built environment, the physical environment, And that speaks to you in a certain way, but I've started to look at kind of the human interaction in that and start trying to learn something about how the transformation of the physical environment also can be reflected in the individual. And so what I started doing was looking at these individuals in the Third Ward neighborhood that have these very special qualities. And as I've said, I think that's the key thing, is to be able to see something special in something first, and to figure out how you can translate that in a way, in an imaginative way, that can become your symbol that you can work toward. And so this is a man by the name of, his name is Eugene Howard, but everyone calls him brother-in-law. And brother-in-law is a, brother-in-law had been in, it's going to take me a little while to tell these stories because they're interesting stories. Brother-in-law had been in prison for a number of years. He got out, moved back to the Third Ward area, but he moved back with no sense of self, no sense of, you know, value in his life as a 57-year-old man who'd been in prison for 20 years, no, uneducated, you know, nothing, no real value there, right? But the thing I started to notice in this guy was how, you know, he had this genuine kind of graciousness about himself. He loved cooking. You know, he would always cook barbecue and show up and just give it to people at the office or whatever, just, you know, just sharing in that way. And so I started kind of thinking about brother-in-law as kind of an institution in himself, you know, and what could someone like that mean with a smile that he has, you know, that has this generosity about himself. So what would he look like? And so I started to kind of look at kind of designing a notion of what brother-in-laws would be. And from this, of imagining brother-in-law, you know, how do you strategically move toward building this reality from the image? And you know, it's very interesting. We've started now by, you know, kind of, you know, I will pay him, or the organization Project Rohizes will pay him for small little catering things. If you were coming down for a tour, it was 15 to 20 of you, brother-in-law would cook, you know, and we would do those same kinds of things. But we're moving towards something that's a little bit more substantial, that maybe, as Delia's Lounge is the name of this old building that was there, representing someone from the past, there may be a brother-in-law's restaurant at some point that's on its way. This is another one. Kenya Shabazz, who is, you know, he's a neighborhood guy. I have 2 more of these to show after this one. But Kenya Shabazz, a neighborhood guy who is kind of a self-proclaimed one person, sometimes 2 persons, Black Panther. And, you know, and he dresses in his regalia and he goes through the neighborhood and he's, you know, and most people don't value what he offers. They think he's a little nutty. They think he's crazy. But, you know, I've watched him over the years and found how this crucial role that he plays within the neighborhood, in terms of placing himself at the neighborhood store after school, making sure that the children are safe and all. I mean, he really plays a significant role. And, so I took a chance to start kind of going out and creating these billboard images of him and putting them around, giving him a renewed sense of who he is as he relates to the community. And it's been really interesting to see how his demeanor has changed and how people have changed in response to him. Even the police has changed their response to him. So there's one more after this one. This is Cookie Love. Cookie Love. I met Cookie Love first as a person who I would see her pushing these grocery carts down the road with these big plastic bags in it. And one day I ended up going to the laundromat and she was there. And I started talking to her and I found out that this woman, every morning at 7 o'clock in the morning, she gets up and she pushes grocery carts out to pick up laundry from people. And she goes and she washed clothes all day. But she's such a diligent worker that the people that own the washaterias, oftentimes, you know, they'll push her out because she has business going all the time. She takes up space for them. And so I started thinking about, you know, how do you take someone who really works hard at trying to figure out, who has an innovative and interesting approach, you know, to providing a service and reframe her in a way where the other thing about Cookie Love, too. It's really funny when I was working on this image and I did the first images of Cookie Love and there was something that was not quite right about it. And it was after someone saw the image and they said, well, where are the chain that she wears? And I forgot about that. That's a key part of Cookie Love, that she always wears her big chain because she locks her push cart up with the chain. But anyway, and so, you know, and so actually, you know, we're moving toward this actually fairly quickly of having a Cookie Love's washing full. And then finally, you know, there are some that are just kind of they're the mysteries, right? And it takes time to kind of figure out, you know, what's the value within this symbol, and how do you take that value and place it in a way that has an ongoing benefit beyond, you know, just the actual image that you can see. And so this one, I haven't resolved that yet, but this guy, his name is Benjamin. And, you know, he works part-time at Project Row Houses, but his thing is he walks through the neighborhood and he just plays his music. And one of the things I thought was really kind of always kind of interesting was that he always made it to these house fires that were happening. At a certain point, there were a lot of these house fires that were happening because, you know, people were just, you know, I don't know if it was arson or what, but they were just constantly burning, and he was always there to make these burnings. But what, to me, in closing, I'll just say, you know, this to me became symbolic of this idea of an image that we have, and we can study, we can try to understand it in a way that could give us information and footing to kind of step beyond the image and move the meaning of that image into a different context. Thank you.
Great.
Thank you, Rick. Sorry, that was loud. So, according to our format, we are now going to either leave Rick at the up there or as you wish, and encourage the agent provocateurs, this American word I came up with, to ask questions. We have Alfred Zollinger from the Architecture School, who's hiding in the back. Susan Yelovich, who's here from the Art and Theory School, and Lydia Matthews, the Dean of Academic Affairs, with whom I have the pleasure to work on a daily basis, and Ken, who is near me, who designed the exhibition, as I mentioned, and Bob Rubin couldn't make it today.
So. Thank you, Leticia. Thank you, Rick. Rick, your project, not unlike many of the other projects within the exhibition, and in a way, certain aspirations of the exhibition itself, before any kind of visualization or any kind of action takes place, a kind of infrastructure is built. And that infrastructure is a kind of grassroots infrastructure, and that's very unique to your work and a number of the other projects. And I was wondering if you could talk about how you see infrastructure working on that kind of grassroots level, and in particular in relationship to Project Row Houses.
I'm not so much of a planner, you know, and I, it's hard. I don't. it's very challenging for me to kind of map out, you know, a project or map it out from start to finish. I kind of start where it is, you know, and the first part of the infrastructure is whatever I can bring to the process, and then I start from there and start looking outward. I do know that, and I do feel that, infrastructure is one of those things that it's a tricky thing because you need it, right? And you can think of all the things that you need, but I think just coming at it from an artist's perspective, and seeing yourself as a key resource to the infrastructural, you know, aspect, then you have a different relationship to it, you know, because you're not waiting for that kind of that infrastructure that can help move you through, because you are a big part of it. And I also know that, you know, there's been times that I've tried to think about infrastructure in different ways and was consumed in building the infrastructure and was never able to move on the actual project.
Right.
You know, and I think with Project Row Houses, the success of it continuing and moving has been the belief in myself as a part of the infrastructure and seeing other immediate, you know, components. Mm-hmm. You know, as I work with and talk to Edgar on the Watts House project, which is, you know, in LA, which he kind of took he took the project from where I left off on it, or where I kind of moved away from it, and we constantly have these conversations about, you know, what is about infrastructure, because he's very, you know, consumed with this notion of, because he looks at Project Row Houses and says, you know, you have a certain kind of infrastructure, mm-hmm. that I know I need, right? And he sees that infrastructure as something to, you know, that he's aspiring to, but at the same time, that infrastructure is not relevant to the place that he is in that stage of the project. So I think it's about understanding the relevant needs, mm-hmm. to where the project is.
Hi, Rick. I'm Susan. Sorry. first of all, I think it's fascinating that one of the first images you showed portraits, painted portraits in the windows of the shotgun houses, and you've come back to a kind of portraiture. And it reminded me of a project in Colombia where residents of a very ravaged neighborhood did murals of either their interiors or themselves on the outside of their houses, so people could see who they were. And so that's just an observation that I found it very evocative. The question I have is, I love the emphasis on memory. Is there ever a danger that you run into that you're creating a museum? And do residents ever say, well, we desire something else?
Hmm. Yeah, you know, I think that's a very good question. You know, it's really trying to figure out, you know, a balance between, you know, how much is about memory and how much is about, you know, kind of moving in, you know, in new and different ways. You know, actually, that's a big part of the conversation that we've been having with our partners at Rice University, because what was really interesting about that relationship, for me, not being, you know, an architect, you know, designer, was that, you know, I could sense from my kind of on the ground listening activities that there was a real need, a real specific need for memory, you know, in the beginning of that project, right? And so, not only the preservation of the, you know, the existing houses, but there had to be some kind of link to the future that was connected to what was in the past. But, you know, and we've done a significant amount of design work that links us to, you know, the historic design of the shotgun houses. And it's at this point that we know right now that we have to depart from that also, you know, because there is a sense that there are some people that, you know, from a community standpoint, that are pushing for, you know, something that has a more modern, you know, kind of design language to it. And so it's one of those things that I think it's extremely, you have to walk that line in the middle. But once again, though, like the little project in Eatonville, Florida, I mean, it's very obvious how that community is in a state that they're grasping for their history and their memory of place, but they see physically around them that is completely, you know, transformed. I mean, the history is no longer there. So the question for them and the challenge, and I don't know what the answer is, and this is going to be a tough design process, though, is, you know, how does that city build itself in the future with reverence for memory without trying to mimic, you know, something from the past? And it's going to be a tough challenge.
The girls first. Thank you. Rick, it was a real pleasure to be introduced to Cookie Love and brother-in-law and the rest of your crew there. And that actually made me start to think about the aspects of your project as I've watched it evolve since, you know, around the mid-90s or something, and the ways in which things can be made visual, and the power of the image in exhibition settings or in articles or in sort of formalized presentations of your work, and then the things that remain invisible in a way based on the kinds of conventions of exhibition practice or the conventions of writing about public art or whatever it might be, and how many of these kinds of what I see as the richest details about the human exchange and the kind of intervention that makes in economic and cultural and social systems, you only kind of access through these sort of one-on-one presentations or, you know, other kinds of means that don't somehow make it directly into the exhibition. And so I'm thinking about reflecting back on what I learned about your project along the way and the things that seem to be the crux of the most interesting and sometimes invisible aspects. And I may get the details wrong, but as I'm remembering initially when you started the project, one of the things that was most interesting was there was a model of public art practice that the NEA had a seed money option. And again, I'm thinking about these things in terms of how people think about prototyping your work somehow or how that could be used in another setting and the problems that you're suggesting there. And one of the things I thought was most exciting about what your approach was that rather than just having a corporation like, I don't know, Home Depot or a business or something offer X number of money to match the funds, they actually offered to let their labor force off for the number of hours it would cost to pay that money. And those people then came down to the Third Ward and actually helped work on the project. And so suddenly there was a kind of human investment that was different than what, you know, often makes it onto the visual image of the row houses themselves, which always intrigued me because I thought, wow, you really kind of mixed up neighborhoods and life experiences and people learned kind of in a two-way street on that. And then in terms of the Uncommon Sense show that was at then the Geffen in Los Angeles at MoCA, I was concerned when I first saw that Watts project that, again, somebody would want to sort of prototype the image and apply it to, you know, I don't know. I mean, the fear was like, is this going to be like McRow houses nationwide and people are going to be all over this and inviting you? And yet there the intervention seemed to be about the idea that you could use the museum setting as the place where people came and signed up to actually be involved in the project, in the making of the project. So again, now today's presentation, I'm like so thrilled to meet these people in the neighborhood and see how the exchanges have evolved. And I'm just wondering about what this, you know, whether it's a space to reflect on how this stuff gets packaged in exhibitions and how we can try to find ways of making visible some of these really rich and yet what would otherwise seem like random aspects that seems so rich and exciting and potentially worth considering more deeply on a critical level.
Yeah, I've always been one that's been somewhat a little bit skeptical of exhibitions. You know, I mean, that's kind of a tough position to have being an artist. I've never really felt completely satisfied with the ability of exhibitions to be able to relay that kind of intimacy, you know, that you're talking about. It's a very challenging thing. So for me, it's always, whenever I think about, you know, exhibition, you know, I think about exhibition as a link, you know, and trying to make it as interesting as a thing in itself and in the place that it is, but it's really, you know, a link to some other place. The Watts House project at MoCA was certainly, it was a link. You know, there was this other little project that I kind of skipped through with this youth group, was at the Contemporary Arts Museum in Houston, which was a link to something. And I also think all kinds of exhibitions, and Glenn is here who worked on the Delray Beach project, and one of the things that was interesting about, you know, this cultural loop was really an exhibition, right? But and what we're trying to do, you know, from my view as an artist that was kind of the lead artist, but the other artists that worked on that project was to kind of, even though it was a public exhibition, but even to take the public exhibition beyond this stand-aside exhibition, but it was in the context in which, in order to experience the exhibition, you were experiencing the thing that was outside of it. You know, so it was kind of one in the same. And I'll give you an example of something that I'm having a hard time with right now. And this is just one of those kind of technical things about, you know, raising money, you know, as it relates to sustaining, you know, these kind of projects. You know, I have a group that, you know, I have a board with Project Row Houses, and, you know, they have a development group that raise money and that kind of stuff, and they kind of have to sit around and figure out how to do that. And I don't want to step in their way when they're raising money. That's good, right? But I'm also concerned about the authenticity of the experience of, you know, what the place is, you know, and how people get that. And so, you know, just a few weeks back, you know, there was this discussion about doing this fundraiser, and they want to do it within the neighborhood, and they want to have it so that people would actually come and, you know, give testimonies about, you know, their experience. But my thing is, like, if you're in the neighborhood, why do people have to come and testify? Why don't you go out, you know, into the neighborhood, and trying to figure out how you design even things like that in a way that connects people with, you know, it's so much easier to have things, you know, to have people have the experience in a symbolic way, because it's less messy. But, you know, I don't think you get that kind of intimacy that you're talking about in a kind of a sterile environment of the exhibition or these kind of isolated ways. It has to be messy.
Rick, my question is maybe less about the idea of exhibition in this whole equation here, because I think you're making it very clear that it is about the experience of the actual thing, right? So what I'm interested in is, and I'm coming from this as having been trained as an architect, is how you as an artist are able to infiltrate or operate within these situations, right? How do you act? And because I know there's all these stereotypes of, you know, what an artist is, what an architect is, and what we do. And
first thing is not act like an artist.
Right. So, but how, obviously, being part of it, but how, if you could maybe share some of these ways in which people initially respond to you entering into these projects, right? You are an artist. You're not going to declare yourself in that way, presumably. But how do you work that? And presumably, there's a time element involved there too, right? Which if we go back to the experience of an exhibition in the image, which has a shorter duration, but you as somebody acting and making this thing of how, maybe a little bit more about how you do that.
Yeah, it's funny you asked that question just as one of my my favorite people walked in the room, Mr. Colbert himself, Mel Chin, who's worked with Mel on a bunch of stuff, and I think probably that's where I kind of learned that whole notion of, you know, if you're working with people in, you know, from different backgrounds, you know, and they may be a little bit skeptical of you as an artist or whatever, is just don't do it as an artist. You know, I mean, just work with them as, you know, in whatever way that is most comfortable, you know, for them. I do try to, because I, particularly with Project Row Houses, I mean, Project Row Houses kind of run the gamut, you know, and I'm a generalist. I'm not an expert really in this project in any way. You know, I'm not an architect or designer. You know, I'm not, you know, an education expert. I'm not a real estate developer. I'm not a contractor. I'm not a social service worker, any of those things. But on any given day, you know, my interactions may have to, you know, address, you know, those fields. And so, you know, my thing is to constantly also too is, you know, I try to keep my presence down, you know, in a project as much as possible, and try to lean as heavily on the infrastructure. That's another, going back to your question about infrastructure, is really understanding, you know, what resources are available that could be a part of that infrastructure. You know, I mean, if there's, you know, if I'm having to do something that deals with a social service issue, and I've identified a social service worker that could be a part of my infrastructure, then I don't need to go and speak to social service people, you know, about the social service issue. You know, and that becomes key to building an infrastructure in a way that that allows you to allow everybody to stay in their comfort zone and willing to kind of, you know, step out and not feel threatened because they're, you know, working with people they don't understand.